it's either keep quiet or it's about going through the legal system.
Right.
And that avenue is not the avenue that many people want to take. In talking to survivors, many survivors that never even considered the idea of going to the police. So what did I want? I wanted it to stop.
Hello, and welcome to Prestasia Foundation's podcast series, Sex, Human Rights, and CSA Prevention. This month, we have the pleasure of speaking with Ignacio Rivera, who is a trans, non-binary, queer abuse survivor who works as an activist, writer, educator, and artist. Their preferred pronouns are they, them. Okay, so welcome, Ignacio. Nice to speak with you today.
Thank you.
To start, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, my name is Ignacio Rivera, or my full name, Ignacio Jutia Shaiti Rivera. That's my indigenous name. I am a sexual healer, a writer, a performance artist. I am the director of the HEAL Project, which is Hidden Encounters, Altered Lives, and it's a project made possible by the Just Beginnings Collaborative Fellowship. And so I've been a fellow for 4 years, and I've been able to actually get some work off the ground. It's been work that I've done for about 15 years, but with no funding.
Wow.
Because really there's no funding out there for this type of work. So it was a labor of love, and when I found a friend passed me the information, and I was really happy to get the fellowship. So through the HEAL Project, I do a variety of things. Mostly it is a lot of education, and it's trying to create a cultural shift in how we do quote-unquote prevention of child sexual abuse. And my platform is that what I used to call comprehensive sex education now is holistic sexuality information. Okay. is a tool to preventing child sexual abuse.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about how comprehensive sex education in general is a tool in CSA prevention?
Right. So I do, the work that I've been doing is like kind of two ends of a spectrum. So it's like on one end, it's prevention work, and that is working with adults, family members, anyone connected to a child, in how to have these conversations, right? To expand it beyond one conversation when a child is a teenager, but to have all of these things, right? Yeah. And on the other end, it's healing work with adult survivors of child sexual abuse or any kind of sexual violence. Okay. In that work with adults and even my own kind of healing work, there's a common thread. And that common thread is that most of us didn't know anything about our bodies, about sex, about consent. And it's weird for me to say this. It's almost understandable because of the generation, right? And if you go a generation before mine, it's worse. And a generation
right,
before mine, it's
right,
worse.
Right, of course.
So it's like I'm doing this work to kind of shift this generational like epidemic of child sexual abuse. So learning that from myself and from other people, I said we need to go back and really, this is what we need to be talking about. What sexuality is, and actually broaden that concept, because we have a very, very limited view of what sex is, and that's it's just it doesn't serve us to be so so tiny.
Yeah. When sex is such a big world, when you really start getting into it, kind of that Pandora's box thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so changing gears just a little bit. Actually, before I change gears a little bit, so you mentioned consent, and that's something that in the kink community, which I'm a part of, we talk about a lot. It is unfortunate that you sometimes don't have that conversation until you get to like 18 or 21 or whenever it is that you kind of set, like sort of step carefully into the kink world at first. Have you worked at all with the kink community? Do you think there's value in working with the kink community, especially vis-a-vis ending CSA?
Yes, I am also a part of the kink community. I've been active, you know, member or participant for over 20 years. And so I think, yes, it's super vital. Like when I talk about my own healing practice, I say that everything I learned about consent and negotiation and my agency of my own body, I learned in the kink community. I learned all positive messages in the kink community about sex and sexuality. I was like, why didn't I know this before?
I have heard similar.
It's like, what a concept. Like we think of the kink community as this horrible thing in the corner. And really, It's like everything we've been waiting for.
It's amazing the conversations I started having in the kink community versus like mm-hmm. the vanilla world. I was like, this is how we should be yeah. doing it. Absolutely, I agree with you.
Yeah.
So since we've talked about healing a little bit, let's talk about, I mean, you wear a lot of hats, you do a lot of work. What does self-care look like for you?
Oh, self-care changes. It shifts for me. It's been doing, you know, meditation, yoga. Uh-huh. I'm very much into nature, ecotherapy. I practice that. My spiritual work, my indigenous spirituality, all of those things, right? But even in those practices that I have, I've realized that doing this work, it's a constant check-in about what needs to uh-huh. shift. Even though I'm leading this work with the Hill Project, it doesn't exempt me from still having my own issues, my own obstacles as a survivor. So I really have to be even more intentional about my uh-huh. self-care, because I can take on a lot of other people's stuff. And uh-huh. I am an empath and I'm intuitive. And so yeah. all of those things uh-huh. really affect me. Yeah, that's a constant conversation with myself. What is good? What's making me feel good? What do I need? And self-care is also not just a solo thing for me. Uh-huh. It also includes my chosen family. So uh-huh. I can do things on my own, but in those moments where I can't, I have my chosen family that can really help push me to do the things that they know help me to ease me and to ground me.
So that's what works for you. Do you have tips that you can think of off the top of your head for other people doing this kind of work? Because I know that, like, for me, it can definitely get very, it's a lot.
Yeah. I think what's worked for me is routine and ritual.
Okay.
Routine and ritual works well. I think for a lot of survivors, we have a lot of, we want certainty. We want clarity.
Mm-hmm.
We need to know this is this, you know, like
right.
I need to know that exit. I need to feel safe.
Right, right.
And so I think there's a safety and a beauty in ritual. And my rituals include, like, before I go to bed, mm-hmm. possibly sitting in front of my altar and meditating
mm-hmm.
or writing what I call a brain dump every night, because we live in our heads so much.
We do, yeah.
Sometimes it's like, I just got to write, do a free write and just dump all this out of my brain so that I can sleep better.
Gotcha, okay.
It could also look like a cup of chamomile tea.
Mm.
Hot
bath.
Turning off the television 2 hours before I want to go to bed. Like, it sounds like little things, you know, very small things, but they really do add up and they mm-hmm. really do help.
Absolutely.
But I think one of the most important healing things for me is, like, being out in nature, that energy, like, raising my own vibration and just mm-hmm. being in beauty really is helpful.
That sounds good. Those are good tips. Thank you. So you're an artist, and we hear a lot about using art for healing trauma mm-hmm. and for processing trauma, but we don't hear much about it as harm reduction and prevention. Do you think that art can be used as harm reduction, as CSA prevention?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It could be used on the whole spectrum, healing, prevention. Again, the things that we need that are so important are the things that are just slashed immediately
uh-huh.
in schools that don't have art programs or music programs or anything uh-huh. like that. It's just so horrible, because it's such a beautiful expression for people.
Uh-huh.
We expect people to have a kind of a cookie cutter model for prevention and healing, and we don't have, like, various avenues for people to express, and art is one of them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard from many survivors that using music has saved their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Just listening to music and lyrics that people put out can save
right.
their lives. And art therapy absolutely saved my life. Like,
okay.
really doing art therapy, we need to have more access to art therapy. It's a beautiful mode of expression when we have no words, and we know that we struggle a lot to even put words to the trauma that we've experienced. And sometimes drawing something or painting something,
uh-huh.
even if it doesn't make sense to anyone else, it's a sort of a release. So I think it's really important that we use art more.
Absolutely. So you mentioned being a survivor. As a CSA survivor, do you believe in rehabilitation for those who have offended?
That's an interesting question. What what I believe is that we most definitely have to stop talking about harm doers or perpetrators as evil monsters. Mm-hmm. It doesn't serve anybody to do that. What we have done for the longest time is this, we've had one kind of way of deal. No, actually two kinds of ways of dealing with this sort of trauma. It's either keep quiet, mm-hmm. or it's about going through the legal system.
Right.
And that avenue is not the avenue that many people want mm-hmm. to take. In talking to survivors, many survivors said I never even considered the idea of going to the police. What did I want? I wanted it to stop.
Right.
I wanted my family to know. And that's just totally reoccurring. Mm-hmm. Some people it works for. But even within that legal system, it's a process of demonizing, most times, the survivor, depending on who the survivor was, but this ostracizing or, like, ousting of...
kind of an otherness.
Yeah, the villain. And then it's like, okay, now we can forget about that mm-hmm. person and we can move on, but it really doesn't do anything.
Right.
Doing that doesn't actually heal mm-hmm. the person. Maybe it might help a little in some senses, but there's a long road to healing. And then that person, what sort of support and services are they going to get? And we often talk about harm doers as, you know, let them go to prison so that they can get a taste of what they've done. Mm-hmm. And even though, you know, I would say that that is a legitimate feeling to have for people who are mm-hmm. suffering, it's not the answer. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know what that could look like, but I know that we need to have more than the legal system, transformative justice approaches mm-hmm. to dealing with harm doers. And I know people who actually work with perpetrators or harm doers, mm-hmm. and they have done amazing work. I know it's not work that I can do. It takes mm-hmm. a special kind of person to do that, just like Absolutely. It takes a special kind of person to work with children who mm-hmm. have been traumatized in that way. That it is definitely a conversation that we need to open up drastically because the things that we've done, like chemical castration, mm-hmm. as if the non-functioning of a penis would deter anyone from sexually assaulting or raping anyone, mm-hmm. we have very limited views of even what rape is, what constitutes rape,
right.
What it means when... there are female perpetrators or harm doers. Mm-hmm. There's so much that we don't tackle with the throwing away because it's so much easier.
Right.
Throw them away. We don't have to think about it.
Take the stigma and
right.
don't bother to move yeah. on from there. You did mention as a CSA survivor, you felt stigma. Mm-hmm. Or sorry, you didn't say mm-hmm. that, but CSA survivors tend to feel stigma.
Yeah.
Anybody who reports rape tends to end up feeling that. Can you talk a little bit about what that experience is like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think we all have a little bit of stigma because of the way sex and sexuality is in this country. Sexism, mm-hmm. I mean, the whole gamut, like we question ourselves, you know, depending on, did I lead someone on? Did I wear the wrong thing? Mm-hmm. Or was it really that? Maybe it was just a mistake. And we're so afraid because we just don't get the support that we need if we talked about it. And the ramifications of talking about it, right? It doesn't end at someone just saying, this happened to me. Mm-hmm. There's a ripple effect of the offense, right? Mm-hmm. And then it takes the person to speak and it just goes on. It doesn't stop. And it hasn't stopped for me. You know, my abuse happened when I was 8, 9 years old, mm-hmm. And I am damn near close to 50, and I am still suffering those effects very,
very much
so.
That is a
very
long time to carry
so.
That.
Yeah.
Would you say that in some ways it's as just damaging as the original trauma?
I would say that...
Or that it can be, perhaps?
If gone checked or helped, it can be very, very damaging because it affects everything. It affects how you communicate, mm-hmm. Information that you share, how you let people in, intimacy, like so mm-hmm. many things. And if you add, having children, what it is like for survivors when they have children, it just adds a whole nother layer mm-hmm. and we just continue this cycle, right? So, yeah.
I can imagine having children would really... could add some anxiety on mm-hmm. top of existing trauma. Since you've mentioned having children, I'd mm-hmm. like to change gears once again. And can you tell me what pure love is?
Oh, yes. Pure love is an initiative of the HEAL Project, and mm-hmm. it is a kind of a talk show that my daughter and I have on YouTube. And we did that because I was out doing a lot of like education around the work that I am proposing and my sexuality model, and people were like, we need some, you know, we need some concrete stuff. Like, how do you do this? How do you do this? So I talked about my toolkit that I am developing right now. I'm in the throes of developing this toolkit that hopefully will be in a variety of ways, whether it'll be a handbook and an app or a game for families to use to talk about, you know, sex and sexuality with their kids. But Pure Love is like, it was a very immediate response to those questions for guardians that were like, okay, I get this framework is good, but like, what do I do if my 7-year-old asks me about, you know, kink? What do I say? Or what if
my... Which is becoming more and more likely.
Yeah, what if my 8-year-old is masturbating in front of everybody? What do I do? You know, I said, well, you know, I didn't have a framework when I was raising my daughter. And so what I could do is share the good, the bad, and the ugly. I can share how I tried to raise her in a sex-positive household so that we can have more of a, I don't know, like a camaraderie about, like, we don't know this shit. We're trying to learn it all together.
We're all learning as we go along.
And all we could do is share information and say, this actually worked for me. Like, really talking to my daughter openly about sex and sexuality, about sex work, about... everything, just everything. She asked me questions. I told her the answers. And when she didn't ask me questions, I gave it to her anyway. And we developed an amazing relationship. Okay. And so I felt like with the work that I did with her, just talking about sex and sexuality, like on a daily basis, was a clear relationship builder for us. And we became very close with that. So we share stories of that.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And it's been really an amazing project to do with her. And we're in our second season right now. And it's interesting because my daughter just had a baby. So now it's 3 generations of us. And talking about being a mother and, you know, how she wants to raise her son, which is very interesting, like raising a black boy in this country right now. And
Wow. You mentioned a little bit, but like, what is it like working with her? Is it fun? Are there like unique challenges that come, like, are you good at pressing each other's buttons?
No, it is really good. I think the only challenge that we've had was like, me giving her more responsibility in terms of, I was like, okay, I've been shooting this, editing this, and putting it out. So let's divvy up some of the responsibility. So she's learning how to, do some more work with the podcast. But when we get on and we start talking, we don't script it or anything. We just get on, we have the topic, and we just talk. So it's pretty much not much editing at all, unless we, you know, mess up a little bit. But I like it because she's kind of digging into what she remembers as a kid. And then I'm talking about, you know, being a parent who is a survivor and everything I was going through internally and externally, and just the fears, you know, fears of, being pregnant, having a child when I was young, and all of these things. So,
Do you think being a young single, you were a single parent?
Is that I identified as an independent mother.
Gotcha. So you a relatively young independent mother, and has that informed your feel? Like, if you'd had children older, or if you'd had your child older, do you feel like maybe you would have been more conservative in the raising? Do you think that... Do you think that youth was part of what informed how you ended up choosing to be open with her?
I don't know. Maybe. Because, you know, I often think about it and say, if I had to do it all again, I'd probably have my daughter at the same age.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think things were really fresh in my mind, you know, about how I wanted to do this differently and what I needed to do to make that happen. So, yeah, maybe. I don't know if conservative would be the right word for me, but it might be a little different. It might have been a little different, yeah.
Okay. I mean, I suppose that's the question about, like, that's the kind of question you can't ever fully answer, but just, you know, curiosity for me. And so you mentioned it, and I wanted to know if you would talk more about, or if you had more to say about the toolkit, because I did look at your website, and the toolkit looks amazing. One of my pet initiatives is always... comprehensive sex ed at a younger age than we're teaching it. And personally, I do work with children. I start very early, just telling them what I'm doing while I'm changing diapers.
Right. Exactly. It's like that simple. Yeah. So the toolkit is sort of like, it's going to be sort of like this life hack for parents, guardians, grandparents. And when I kind of use the term caregiver, because I just want to be like very open, because we're all connected to a kid. Because somebody would say, well, I never gave birth. I was like, are you an auntie? I was like, you got a kid in your life. You have opportunities to talk to a young person at some point. So it's really like sharing lots of scenarios. My hope was that is that people would submit some of their stories, because I feel like we all have the answers, right? We're just kind of collecting these answers, right? So I'm hoping that people will submit their stories, their tips, their tricks, things that have worked for them. And then I have a plethora of these tips that I am adding that are my own personal tips that have helped me raise my daughter. And not only that, just little stories. And I've also am interested in people sharing their fears, right? Because why we don't talk to our children about this is because we are leading everything with fear. It's mostly about don't be a slut, don't get pregnant, don't get HIV, don't get an STI. All negative fear. Never like, oh, sex can be a beautiful, amazing thing if it's the conditions are right. And what I mean by those conditions is this and this. You know, talking really honestly and openly. So it's about really modeling what that could look like, like not to freak out, to really teach from many perspectives. That's one thing that I kind of push really hard on people, because we often teach from our own perspective because it's what we know. But we miss out on a lot of in the intersectionality of sex and sexuality is completely left out, because if a parent is heterosexual, they're probably going to just talk to their kids about heterosexuality. And what if that kid ends up being gay? So they're learning right then and there that that wasn't even important enough to talk about, and that something is wrong with them. So they can't actually talk to their parents, right? So we start internalizing the messages, but also the absence of messages. So it really just talks about this many perspectives things, whether you agree with it or not, because the reality is we live in a world that has many views. And if we give our children the information, then we're actually teaching them how to make better decisions, how to assess different things, and not to accept that there's one way of doing something. And in thinking like that, we all become much more successful in relationships. It's a win-win situation. You know, it's totally a win-win because we have all the information. So that's hopefully what the toolkit is going to do, like show people that it's really not that scary. It's really a wonderful experience and a good thing. And it's not just for children. It's actually a tool for adults to get in touch with their own sexuality as well. Because one of the major blocks is, how the hell do I teach my kid when I don't even know?
No one taught me.
No idea. So it's like, okay, don't get scared. I'm going to talk to you about this. And we're going to, because it's on the same spectrum. It's really the same spectrum on talking about all those things. So hopefully it's a kind of a dual, a multi-prong approach to this toolkit.
That sounds amazing. And so is that something, I know you're still in development, is it something that like parents will pay for? Is it part of like giving it to the community type of situation? Because I know that as a nonprofit, Prestasia has to bring in something for operation costs. So just out of curiosity.
I envision it being a variety of ways. Accessible to folks, because my main concern is, you know, people at the margins, poor people, people that don't have resources and access to stuff. So I'm most definitely going to make that available. And I have to work in a system that organizations and companies will pay for this so it can support the people that need it the most.
That's amazing. Let's see. Do you have a favorite sort of horror story that anybody has brought to you? Something that, like, a question of just, oh my gosh, I have no idea what's going on. My kid just asked me this. I've never heard of anything like that. Like, if you have a favorite.
I you know, it's really mostly always about masturbation.
Why am I not surprised?
It's that's like the major thing, because people just freak out about what do I do, because, you know, they're touching themselves and they're doing it in front of people and, you know. So I think it's that, because they just are shocked, and don't know. But I think adults make it much harder than it is, because it can simply be, you know, hey, what are you doing? You know, like, right. And talk about privacy. It's a great opportunity to talk about privacy, right. And not body shame, you know. But it's mostly about masturbation.
Gotcha. Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today. It was really very fascinating and quite a treat.
Thank you
very much.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this month's episode. Please subscribe to make sure you don't miss next month's episode. If you're watching on YouTube, our channel icon and a donation icon are right here. See you next month!